Today is Tuesday, April 20th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. The prosecution and defense made their closing arguments in the trial of a white former police officer accused of killing an African-American man.
In closing statements, defense attorney Eric Nelson said it wasn't a lack of oxygen that killed Floyd. Prosecutor Steve Slasher told the jury Chauvin had to have known what he was doing to Floyd.
Plus, a Rwandan report concludes that the French government bears some responsibility for the 1994 genocide, and history is made on the planet Mars. We'll have these stories and more next. In Minneapolis, Minnesota, the murder case against white former police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd, an African-American man, has gone to the jury. The AP's Ed Donahue starts us off.
In closing statements, defense attorney Eric Nelson said it wasn't a lack of oxygen that killed Floyd.
The drug ingestion, right? The bad heart, the diseased heart. The hypertension.
Prosecutor Steve Slasher told the jury Chauvin had to have known what he was doing to Floyd.
He hurt him, but he just didn't listen. He continued to push him down.
Slasher also pointed out it's all on video.
That force for 9 minutes and 29 seconds, that killed George Floyd. He betrayed the badge.
Tape from court TV. Chauvin showed little expression. He took off his mask as his attorney presented his closing statement. I'm Ed Donahue.
A report commissioned by the Rwandan government concludes that the French government bears significant responsibility for enabling a foreseeable genocide that left more than 800,000 dead in 1994. The report that the Associated Press was able to read comes amid efforts by Rwanda to document the role of French authorities before, during, and after the genocide. This is France's president, Emmanuel Macron, has tried to improve relations with the Central African country. The study was made public on Monday after its formal presentation to Rwanda's cabinet. It concludes that in years prior to the genocide, former French President François Mitterrand and his administration had knowledge of preparations for the massacres, yet kept supporting Rwanda's government, and it comes less than a month after a French report commissioned by Macron concluded that French authorities had been blind to the preparations for genocide and then reacted too slowly to appreciate the extent of the killings and respond to them. For the report's reaction in France, I spoke with reporter Catherine Field in Paris.
The general feeling in the French president's office is that these two reports are part of a reconciliation process between France and Rwanda. These are reports that create a new political arena, as they call it, for a new way forward for relations between the two countries. So they do very much welcome both of these reports, really. Emmanuel Macron has made it very clear that France can't hide behind any sort of claim to secrecy over this. In fact, he's ordered the opening of archives that date from 1990 to 1994. That is really something that we've not seen the French do before, particularly in this. And they're really looking forward to a new beginning. And part of that new beginning will, of course, happen, all going well, in May, when the Rwandan president, Paul Kagame, comes to France for the International Financing Summit for Africa. So very much looking at the positive, even though both reports very clearly say that France bears significant responsibility for enabling the genocide in Rwanda to have taken place.
Catherine, as I understand it, there were some politicians who spoke out last week in response to the French report. What have they said?
The prime minister at the time of the genocide, Edouard Balladur, he is a conservative prime minister, he said that he completely disagreed with the findings of the French report. He said that France didn't have anything to apologize for. He said that he did everything that could possibly be done to stop France being accused of being indifferent or passive to what was going on in Rwanda at the time. And he was quite firm in an interview with French television when he said that there's nothing to apologize for. And in fact, it should be other countries. In particular, he said the US and even the UN should be apologizing for not having done more. At the same time, his then foreign minister, Alain Juppé, in an editorial in Le Monde, gave a very different reply. He said, and I'm quoting here, he said, "For almost 30 years, I carried this wound of failing to prevent this terror. So two very different responses from French politicians, and really you just goes to show that there are still certain sections of the French political elite who do have concerns that France has lost its influence in Africa, that it really should have done more to protect its influence in Africa. And in fact, that was something that both reports came up with, that this, the French fear of losing influence in Africa blinded France and its diplomats and its military to stepping in some way to have tried to prevent the genocide in Rwanda.
And one last question, Catherine. We are talking about two different reports here, the one that was commissioned by French President Emmanuel Macron and the one by the Rwandan government. Are they divergent, or are there a lot of similarities between the two?
They do fairly much come to the same conclusion. The only difference I would say is that the report coming out of Rwanda alleged that France was, and I'm quoting here, a collaborator of the Hutu regime. And that's really to be expected, because there has always been criticism that the then French president, President Mitterrand, had a very strong personal and direct relationship with the then Hutu president of Rwanda. So it's perhaps not surprising that it was the Rwandan report that mentioned far more specifically the personal relationship between the two presidents at the time.
Catherine Field spoke to me from Paris, France. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Steve Miller. The European Union's top diplomat says Russia has concentrated more than 150,000 troops on Ukraine's border and in annexed Crimea. Reuters' Emma McCarthy has more.
Joseph Borrell declined to give a source for the figure, but said that the risk of further escalation is evident.
We have to commend Ukraine for its restrained response, and we urge Russia to de-escalate and to defuse tensions.
He said no new economic sanctions or expulsions of Russian diplomats were planned for the time being, after Ukraine's foreign minister called on the bloc to impose new sanctions on Russia on Monday. Tensions between Moscow and Kiev have been on a knife's edge amid the military buildup.
Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. The governments of Ukraine, Russia, Germany, and France met on Monday to help end the conflict in eastern Ukraine between Kyiv's forces and Russian-backed separatists. All sides have reaffirmed their commitment to reaching a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine. As tensions escalate over Ukraine, Russia and NATO ships are increasing their presence in the Black Sea. The growing naval presence is putting increasing scrutiny on the Montreux Convention that governs access to the waterway. And as Jorian Jones reports, Turkey's plan to build a canal that could circumvent the convention is causing alarm in Moscow.
Russia is continuing to build up its naval presence in the Black Sea. And the Sunday Times newspaper, quoting British naval sources, said Britain is also deploying two warships to beef up NATO's presence as tensions over Ukraine escalate. Access to the Black Sea is through Turkey's Bosphorus and Dardanelles waterways, which are controlled by the 1936 Montreux Convention. Retired Turkish ambassador Mithat Rende, a maritime law analyst, says the current tensions underlines the treaty's importance.
Maritime powers, which are not riparian states, they have limited access to the Black Sea because of the limited tonnage that each country cannot keep more than 30,000 tons of capacity in the Black Sea and for a period of 21 days only. So it is probably desirable for certain countries like the United States to have an alternative to Montreux.
Earlier this month, news reports said the Russian President Vladimir Putin pressed his Turkish counterpart Recep Tayyip Erdogan to ensure NATO fully comply with the Montreux Convention. Hussein Baja of the Foreign Policy Institute in Ankara says Moscow sees the convention as key to Russian Black Sea hegemony.
This is the only way which makes Black Sea at the same time Russian Sea, because Russian Navy is there dominating, and the American warships are limited. And it is good for Russia to have Montreux, maybe more than Turkey, I would say.
But the future of the 80-year-old convention could be in question. A Turkish commercial extols the virtues of the Istanbul Canal that would run parallel with the Bosphorus, offering a faster and safer passage for ships. The canal, whose construction is due to start in the coming months, is causing concern in Moscow. Erdogan said this month the canal is not covered by Montreux, opening the door to potential unlimited use by any nation's warships. Turkey-Russian relations analyst Zhao Gazimov at Bonn University says deliberations over Montreux gives Ankara leverage over Moscow.
The Montreux agreement and how Turkey deals with it, that gives new possibilities for Ankara to promote its interests in its interaction with Russia. That gives also certain leverage for Ankara to influence the situation, the dynamics around the Black Sea region, and even also to deepen the cooperation with the United States.
But Erdogan's plans is facing pushback. More than 100 retired Turkish admirals issued a statement this month defending Montreux, claiming it guarantees Turkish control over the Bosphorus. The Turkish authorities put the admirals under investigation, accusing them of threatening the government. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Prison doctors have decided to transfer Russia's main opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, to a hospital 20 days into a hunger strike that has brought international warnings of consequences should he die in jail. Reuters' Lauren Anthony takes it from here.
Russia's prison service said in a statement that Navalny would be taken to a regional prison hospital. His condition was satisfactory and that he was being given vitamin therapy with his consent. Navalny's allies, who have not had access to him since last week, say they are braced for bad news about his health. They're calling for mass countrywide protests this week in a bid to save his life, which they hope will be the largest in modern Russian history. But the Kremlin has said any unauthorized protests in support of Navalny will automatically be considered illegal. The fate of 44-year-old Navalny adds to Russia's severely strained ties with the West. The US imposed new measures last week, targeting sovereign debt and blacklisting Russian companies. And President Biden's national security adviser said Sunday that the government had told Russia there will be consequences if Navalny dies in prison. The Kremlin have shrugged off the pressure and says Russia will continue to respond in kind if further sanctions are imposed. European Union foreign ministers are also expected to discuss the Navalny case on Monday. Josep Borrell is the bloc's top diplomat.
We are very much worried about the health situation of Mr. Navalny. Yesterday, we issued a statement on behalf of the 27 member states asking the Russian authorities to provide the health care he needs, and they are responsible for their safety.
Navalny says prison authorities are threatening to put him in a straitjacket to force feed him. Russia accuses him of exaggerating his medical condition to grab attention and of refusing prison medical care. But they have pledged to ensure he survives.
Lauren Anthony from Reuters. Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, says that he is setting up a commission to investigate the causes of Sunday's train crash north of Cairo and killed 11 people and wounded nearly 100. The country's transport minister, seen on video inspecting the rails at the site of the accident, says that someone sabotaged the track by removing a metal rail and replacing it with a piece of wood. Edward Uranian has that story.
Egyptian Transport Minister Kamel El-Wazir was seen on amateur video inspecting the track where the latest train accident on the country's railroad network took place Sunday. He appears to uncover a piece of wood that he says someone used to replace a metal rail to sabotage a passing train. Wazir told Arab media that he has officially stepped down and has no problems with being replaced by someone else who is more competent, but that the basic problem with the rail network is still going to exist. It is the custom in Egypt that ministers resign after serious accidents for which they are deemed responsible. However, many Egyptians who support the government argued on social media that Wazir should remain in place. Egyptian media showed engineers working to replace about 200 meters of damaged track at the site of Sunday's accident. Modern track laying equipment could be seen installing the new rail section. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who retweeted the transport minister's video inspecting the track, has set up an official commission responsible for investigating the causes of the latest train crash, which is the third in under a month. Saeed Sadiq, who teaches political sociology in Cairo, tells VOA that it appears likely that someone intentionally caused the accident.
There was also many photos that showed that the lines in those area where the accidents had taken place were removed and replaced with wood instead of iron railways. And it also suggested that anybody who did it must have knowledge inside the railway system. So that's why this suspicion is filling social media about the latest accident and pointing fingers to the Muslim Brotherhood or some foreign sponsors.
Midhat Kamel, a passenger on the derailed train, told VOA that the air-conditioned cars crashed after the train appeared to speed up. He says that someone pulled him out, but that everyone next to him was dead. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
On Monday, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for leaders in Asia to bolster efforts towards finding a peaceful solution to the urgent crisis in Myanmar that was sparked by the military coup on February 1st.
Today, ASEAN's role is more crucial than ever as the region faces an urgent crisis in Myanmar. I've repeatedly called on the international community to work collectively and through bilateral channels to help bring an end to the violence and repression by the military. United Nations cooperation with ASEAN in this regard is vital. The situation requires a robust international response grounded on a unified regional effort. I urge regional actors to leverage their influence to prevent further deterioration and ultimately find a peaceful way out of this catastrophe.
Guterres told ambassadors that a special envoy for Myanmar is in the region and stands ready to resume dialogue with the military leaders and others. And according to rights monitoring groups, over 700 people, including 50 children, have been killed by security forces since that February 1st military takeover in Myanmar. A powerful typhoon is barreling towards the Philippines, but if luck holds, it will not make landfall. AP correspondent Charles de Ledesma reports.
Officials say the approaching typhoon has left one person dead after being hit by a falling tree and has prompted the evacuation of more than 100,000 people as a precaution, although the unusual summer storm is not expected to blow into land. A government weather agency administrator says a high-pressure area extending from China to Japan is so far blocking the typhoon from blowing inland. The current forecast is for it to slowly move northwestward and then veer eastward away from the northern Philippines around Thursday. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. NASA, the U.S. space agency, says its miniature robot helicopter, the Ingenuity, has performed a successful takeoff and landing on Mars. Reuters' Matthew LaRotonda has that story.
Altimeter data confirmed that Ingenuity has performed its first flight.
Cheering at NASA on Monday as its little drone helicopter on Mars made a historic flight, marking the first time that humans have controlled an aircraft on an alien planet, and beaming back a single image. Taryn Bailey, an engineer on the project, streamed it live from the Jet Propulsion Laboratory headquarters in California.
So the image we're looking at on the screen is the image from our onboard navigation camera showing us hovering above the surface of Mars. How incredible!
And that's its shadow, right, Taryn?
Yes, that's its shadow. So the onboard navigation camera points straight down, so we're seeing its shadow right now.
I can just hear Mimi in the background. This is real! This is real! It's so amazing.
The helicopter, called Ingenuity, didn't fly for long. This was just a test flight. camera on the Mars rover Perseverance, which was parked about 200 feet away, caught part of it on video. It went up 10 feet, hovered for 39 seconds, and landed again.
Ingenuity's reporting having performed spin-up.
But make no mistake, this is being compared to the Wright brothers' first flight back in 1903, which itself only lasted 12 seconds.
Down. We can now say that human beings have flown a rotorcraft on another planet.
In fact, NASA attached a tiny piece of the original Wright brothers' flyer to the underside of Ingenuity before it was launched to Mars. A piece of history, making history again.
Matthew Liratonda reports for Reuters News. And speaking of NASA, the agency has developed a special app that allows citizen scientists around the world to participate in an Earth science project. VOA's Julie Tabo has that story.
People across the U.S. and around the world are helping scientists at NASA, the U.S. space agency, with an Earth science project. Using an app on their phones, citizen scientists measure the height and width of local trees and share the data with NASA scientists to help them assess the amount of carbon being stored by trees. Jody Haney is a professor emeritus at Bowling Green State University in Ohio, who helps undergraduate math and science students use the app.
We're here at Bowling Green State University, and I have Megan Recker. We're going to be doing a tree observation using the Globe Observer app. Are you ready, Megan?
Oh, yeah.
Participants open the app and select trees from the four main tools, and then a picture of the entire tree. Megan then walks to the tree, counting her steps to determine the distance.
28 steps. We're going to set our longitude and latitude positions.
So now we have the final results,
which show that this tree is about 16 meters tall.
And now, Megan's going to send all her tree data to Globe so that the Globe scientists have access to the measurements that Megan just took.
NASA has satellites orbiting the Earth that measure tree heights from space. The data from app users complements NASA's space observations to help scientists better understand the carbon that trees either take in or release into the atmosphere. Jody Haney via Skype.
So NASA can actually use our data that we've collected from the ground to monitor how good their models are. Are their satellites measuring tree height accurately?
Holly Cole is coordinator of the Globe Observer Program. She spoke with VOA via Skype.
Smartphone technology, the stuff we carry in our pocket every day, includes some pretty sophisticated tools that are useful for data collections. And so when we realized that the technology was advanced enough, we were able to combine those into a tool to bring the public into data collection.
Using the tree tool inspired nature lover Candace Gossin to organize group hikes in the old growth forests of Mount Tabor in Portland, Oregon, and get them involved.
I bring along the app, I bring along the phone, I explain what we're doing. Not only we talk about tree medicine, but we're also talking about how we collectively together are walking and sharing this information with the rest of the world. And so by taking the photos and sharing the information through this app, it becomes a database that anyone anywhere can see.
More than 120 countries are participating in the program so far, with participants finding value in being citizen scientists. Jody Haney.
I find that students of all ages love being part of a bigger picture. When they make a tree observation, they want to see their point and their contribution on the website so that they know that they made a difference, a small difference, but a difference, that they're helping monitor the health of the earth, and that means a lot to them.
Thanks, Megan. Keep doing Globe.
Julie Tabo, VOA News.
And finally, a Ghanaian youth-oriented initiative uses its e-commerce platform, Jawato.com, to fight against climate change by urging its subscribers to contribute to planting trees directly. The online platform also empowers artisans and local women by creating a value chain that enables them to produce quality-made in Ghana products. Africa 54's technology correspondent Paul Ndiho spoke to Jonathan Kojo, the company's co-founder, via Skype.
You are one of those younger budding entrepreneurs who is trying to come up with his own greener revolution. Tell me more about that.
We identify technological trends, and it's quite obvious that e-commerce is one of such trends when it comes to, you know, our jurisdiction, that is Africa. Now, we know that a number of people, because of globalization, can access products from anywhere at all in the world using internet. And this is what we have done. So in our small way, we've come up with a technological platform that is meant to give especially African producers and manufacturers a global market platform while allowing them to use, you know, this same platform to contribute directly to tree planting, that is offsetting the amount of carbon that they emit. So this is what Joato is set to do. And we have rolled out the model, and this is what we are doing at the moment.
If I hear you correctly, your business model, you are sort of like an e-commerce platform, but at the same time, you're trying to get people to contribute to tree planting when they use your services.
Our model basically is trying to get everyone involved in the funding process of tree planting. We know very well that at the moment, we depend on organizations, some few corporate bodies who want to contribute a little to, you know, as a way of contributing to their social responsibilities and all of that. But we are looking at a model that can capture everyone in funding tree planting activities.
How did you come up with this fascinating way of doing business?
One day, I came out from my house and I realized that the tree was cut down. Within a few days, a lady and, you know, in the company of some men were planting a kiosk. You know, after a few months, I realized this kiosk was basically meant to sell shea butter. You know, then I started wondering. I mean, I was trained as a computer scientist, and I was thinking, is there a way to help this woman who, in her quest to make life better, has fallen down a tree, a whole tree that probably was there for about 20 years, maybe, I mean, with the internet, and we can get her to take her products globally just by giving her a store on a website, and at the same time save several other trees that would have been cut down for the purpose of, you know, putting kiosks that will probably serve a few people around that community.
How many people use your platform?
At the moment, we have about 147 sellers, that's vendors, mostly local entrepreneurs. We have up to about 4,000, over 4,000 active subscribers, and we also generate a lot of sales, you know, daily on our platform. Every day we have people believing in our dream. We have people who care about trees also shopping from our platform. And yes, it's more of a new revolution in the e-commerce industry here in Ghana.
How are people embracing this go green revolution?
There's a new wave, and this wave is catching up with people. People are beginning to see the essence of trees. Even children now understand the value of trees. The heat is becoming very unbearable, and the issue of climate change is becoming very real, you know, with very practical examples that we see daily. And we have people, you know, really aligning with us, and also the sellers. They also feel that, look, this is a good opportunity for me to give back to my land. So I would want to sell on your platform, and I would invite my customers to buy on your platform so that we will be able to together give back to the land.
To what extent has climate change had an impact on that part of Ghana where you are?
Northern Ghana can be very hot, with temperatures rising sometimes over 40 degrees. I'm not an expert in climate change, but I always give this one single example. While I was growing up, I remember that when it rained, we had hailstones. And I don't remember the last time I saw hailstones again. And I don't think our children might be seeing hailstones if we don't do something. And I remember talking with my mom, and my mom would always tell me that, look, there used to be a lot of trees. And even as early as January, February, in Northern Ghana, we used to have rains. There's still no rain in Northern Ghana. And I think we understand to the extent of, you know, there's a lot of drought, a lot of heat, these hailstones, farmers can no longer predict the rain. All these, for me, are clear signs that climate change is real. And, you know, we are suffering the consequences of it.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you very much.
And you've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by visiting voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.